Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Katie Weaver, and Anne Ball. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, since the earliest days of the United States, Americans began their days by eating whatever was most easily available. These foods often included bread, eggs, or leftovers, food left over from the night before. Today, ease is still an important factor when it comes to breakfast. However, what people eat has changed over time. And some of today's common breakfast foods, such as cereal, are the result of very effective marketing. Advertising was practically invented to sell cereal, says Heather Arndt Anderson. She is the writer of the book, Breakfast, A History. Arndt Anderson adds, one of the first ways advertising was successfully or effectively used was to convince mothers that it was okay for their children to eat these instant cereals. It sort of offered working mothers a chance to let kids take care of themselves in the morning. As women entered the workforce to help support their families, cereal was a food kids could make on their own. That's still sort of the power, really, the lasting effect of breakfast as being the first meal that kids do learn how to prepare themselves, Arndt Anderson says. Advertising also played an important part in orange juice becoming a morning drink. In 1916, farmers grew more oranges than usual, so advertisers began saying, "Drink an orange." They aimed to persuade people that drinking orange juice was a healthy way to start the day. 2 years later, a worldwide flu epidemic caused people to drink more orange juice for its health benefits. As for coffee, it might have the 1773 Boston Tea Party to thank for its popularity in the United States. In that year, American colonists protested British taxation by throwing tea into Boston Harbor. In time, coffee became so popular that people traveling to the American West in the 1830s made sure to carry coffee beans on the journey. Pancakes have also been around for a very long time. Researchers believe the world's oldest naturally preserved human mummy ate a pancake-like food as one of his last meals. Researchers think pancakes may have been made in the morning because they are much quicker to prepare than bread. Cooks could then have time to make fresh bread for dinner. Americans still eat breakfast foods like bread and eggs that their ancestors did. Writer Heather Arndt Anderson notes that people's concerns about healthy food choices have also stayed the same. She says the idea of clean eating and healthy eating has been around for hundreds of years. She adds, the only thing that's changed has been the details with which we define what these things are, what clean eating is, and being healthy. Arndt Anderson hopes more Americans will see leftovers as a breakfast food. She adds that leftovers taste good and are a great way to reduce waste.
A patient watched pictures appear one by one. First, a bicycle. Next, a treat, a cupcake. Then a picture of the drug heroin. Researchers followed her brain's reactions to the sight of the drug that she has tried to stop taking. U.S. government scientists are starting to study the brains of people caught in the opioid epidemic in the United States. They want to see if medicines proven to treat substance abuse, like methadone, do more than ease the person's desire for the drug. Do these medicines also heal a brain damaged by drug dependency? Which medicine works best for which patient? Studies have found that three medicines can effectively treat what specialists are calling opioid use disorder. They are methadone, buprenorphine, and extended-release naltrexone. Patients who use methadone or buprenorphine cut their chances of death in half. That is a finding from a report by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Nora Volkov is the director of the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA. She is leading the new study. The brain responds differently to these medications than to heroin. It's not the same, she says. Opioid addiction changes the brain in ways that can make people likely to relapse. They start using the drug again after a period of improvement. Researchers believe these changes lessen with long-term abstinence. Volkov thinks medication-based treatment will help those damaged neural networks start getting back to normal faster. To study that idea, she needs to compare brain images from people like the woman who stopped using heroin with active users and people who are in the early days of treatment. Can we completely recover? I do not know that, Volkov said. But with the medications, you're creating stability in the brain, she said. That helps train the brain to react to everyday pleasures again. The problem now is finding enough people willing and healthy enough to have their brains scanned for science. When you find something pleasurable, such as a song or the touch of a loved one, the brain releases a natural chemical called dopamine. It trains the body to remember that it liked something. That is the brain's reward system. Opioids can damage it by causing production of more dopamine than nature ever could. Repeated opioid use overloads nerves in different areas of the brain, including those involved with learning and memory, emotion, judgment, and self-control. At the same time, the brain slowly releases less dopamine when reacting to other things the person once found pleasurable. Eventually, people seek more of the drug not to get high, but to avoid feeling low. Drug addiction is a brain disease, not a choice, not a personality flaw, not a moral failing, says Jody Glantz. She is an addiction specialist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Glantz hopes NIDA's brain scans will help improve the reaction of public health officials to the opioid crisis. Not offering the medicines to people who need them is like not offering insulin to someone with diabetes, she said. Volkov plans to test a mix of untreated heroin users and patients using different medication-based treatments. The patients go inside brain scanning equipment at the National Institutes of Health's Research Hospital. Her team has screened more than 400 people who showed interest in the study. They have found only about 40 people who met the requirements. Of those, 7 are taking part in the program. The main problem? Those being tested must have no other health problem that might affect the brain's chemistry or operation. Volkov said it is worth the struggle to find such rare volunteers if before and after scans end up showing truly different-looking brains as people get treated. You should be able to see it with your eyes without having to be an expert, she said. I'm John Russell.
Sunny Duong went from being a Vietnamese refugee to a career as a dentist in the United States. But his path was not a straight or easy one. Born in Vietnam, Duong came to the U.S. and worked hard as a child. But then he became involved in drugs and crime. Later, he learned the nail beauty business, caring for and shining customers' fingernails and toenails. It is from this job he met the woman who told him he could and should become a dentist. 3 years after the Vietnam War ended, 6-year-old Sonny and his family fled his birthplace. His parents had both been sent to re-education camps after the fall of South Vietnam. His father and others worked together to build a boat in which to escape.
One of 3 children, Sonny was the middle child. His younger brother died in an accident in Hong Kong, where the family lived in a refugee camp before coming to the U.S. Later, in Southern California, Sonny worked hard, helping his parents earn money for food and housing. They would compete on weekends with other refugees for seats on buses, which took them to farms to harvest fruit. He remembers his parents worked long hours at several jobs. They bought machines for their home, where Sonny and his sister helped the parents make baby car seat covers and other products made out of cloth.
The children also cooked and took care of themselves while their parents worked. Sonny's mother and father grew up poor in Vietnam, and neither had much schooling. But they wanted education for their children.
So they didn't have an education, so they don't have anything other than, you know, their determination, just physical labor. So their hopes for my sister and I is, you know, to have a better opportunity to get an education.
So for Sonny and his sister, homework came first. But when he got to high school, Sonny made some bad choices. He began abusing drugs, became involved with a criminal group, and went to jail. Duong told VOA he was guilty to crimes he is not proud of.
I think the reason that happens is because for the most part of my life, I didn't really have an identity. It was really hard to assimilate with Americans in Southern California, and that the only people you had were other refugees. And I think there are a lot of discrimination just growing up just because the Vietnam War just ended.
His father died suddenly in 1994. Then a break came, a telephone call from across the country. In 1996, a friend called Sonny Duong from Richmond, Virginia. He asked the young man to come live with his family and work in their nail beauty business. When his plane landed in Richmond, Duong had less than $20. His hope was to live a clean, drug-free, and honest life. 14 years later, he would graduate from Virginia Commonwealth University with a dentistry degree. With determination, he stopped using drugs and stayed off of them.
He learned the nail business. One of his best customers was a woman named Hazel Luton. She worked at the VCU School of Dentistry. Hazel urged the young man to do more with his life. Sonny Duong learned to work in a dental laboratory at a nearby community college. But he later decided he did not want to work in a lab. He likes people too much. Duong told Hazel he would like to go to dental school, but was not sure if he could do it. It would mean up to 10 years of classes.
And she said, you know, it may take you 10 years, but in 10 years, you can either be a nail technician where you are now, dental lab technician, or a dentist. What title would you prefer to have?
It was, he says, the big moment, and he decided to try. Sonny Duong met a man who gave him determination to finish. Marshall Brownstein worked at the VCU Dentistry School. Dr. Brownstein gave him a list of the classes he would need to take for admission into dental school. Duong put up the list at his home. Every time he would complete one of the classes, he would mark it off the list. Brownstein told VOA he is happy that Duong followed his plan and says he is proud that he became a dentist.
Duong was also driven by a dream he had after his father died. In it, his father was angry, telling him how he sacrificed so much coming to this country for him. Sonny Duong finished at VCU with a degree in biology, becoming the first in his family to get a college degree. Then he was accepted into the VCU School of Dentistry. Up until then, he had worked 50 to 60 hours a week to pay the cost of schooling. But when he went to dentistry school, he stopped working as a nail technician.
In 2010, he finally graduated and became a dentist. Yet, he had large loans to pay back. His plan was to work for a few years at a community health center in Fredericksburg, Virginia, to pay back the money he owed. But he has never left.
The rewards are just immeasurable. The people that I've reached and helped, and the families, kids, and there are three generations in some families that I treat, and the smiles that they have and the joy they bring to me kept me in the program.
Now married and the father of two young boys, Sonny Duong says his education path was not a traditional one. But it is one that is possible, he says, because we live in such a great country.
I always tell people in this political climate that I still feel this is the greatest country ever, because if I put myself when I was 20 years ago in any part of the world, I feel like I couldn't turn my life around and become a dentist, have the opportunity to help people that I help every day.
I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
On our national parks journey, we are exploring the oldest national park east of the Mississippi River. Much of the park sits on a rocky island off the coast of Maine called Mount Desert Island. Here, you will find the tallest mountain on the east coast. You will also find black bears, moose, and more than 300 kinds of birds. This national park also holds unique Native American and European history. It is called Acadia. The 14,000-hectare park is one of the smaller major national parks in the country. Yet Acadia sees almost 3 million visitors every year. They come to experience stunning views and take part in outdoor activities like hiking and biking, and swimming in the crisp blue Atlantic Ocean.
Acadia National Park has had many names throughout history. It was first declared a national monument in 1916. Its name, Sieur des Monts National Monument, was changed by Congress in 1919. It then became known as Lafayette National Park. In 1929, the park became Acadia National Park, from a past name for the area. The name Acadia probably comes from Arcadia, an area of Greece. It is said that an Italian explorer working for the King of France sailed by the area in 1524. The explorer thought that the landscape looked like the Greek area of Arcadia.
Mount Desert Island also got its name from early European explorers. Frenchman Samuel Champlain arrived on the island in 1604. He described the island's tall peaks as bare and rocky. He named the island, in French, Île des Monts Déserts, or Island of Desert Mountains. Today, locals still say the word desert, similar to its French pronunciation, désert. Champlain and his team were not, of course, the first humans on the island. Native Americans were the first to inhabit the area. Shells and other archaeological evidence on the island date back more than 5,000 years. The native Wabanaki people arrived there in boats made from the wood of birch trees. They hunted, fished, collected berries, and harvested clams from the sea. Wabanaki people called the island Pemetic, or sloping land.
This sloping land is home to Cadillac Mountain. It is the highest point along America's eastern coast at 466 meters. The island owes its landscape to ancient glaciers that once covered the area. Cadillac Mountain is known as the first point in the U.S. that is touched by the rising sun each morning. The name of its early inhabitants, the Wabanaki, translates to People of the Dawn. Today, the summit of Cadillac Mountain is often packed with visitors, many of whom arrive in cars and buses. It is one of the major tourist attractions within the park.
Many tourists also visit what may be the most photographed rock in the state. Bubble Rock is a giant boulder. It sits right on the edge of the summit of South Bubble Mountain. It was moved here by powerful ancient glaciers. Bubble Rock looks as though the slightest wind may push it over the mountain's edge. Visitors often take photos of themselves trying to push the huge rock off the mountain. Of course, Bubble Rock does not move. The Bubble Rock Trail winds up South Bubble Mountain. It is one of the most popular hiking trails in the park. But Acadia does offer solitude for visitors hoping to enjoy the quiet of nature. Within the park are more than 200 kilometers of trails. Many lead to stunning views of the rocky main coast. Some take you to pebbled beaches or quiet lakes surrounded by forest.
Many visitors to Acadia spend most of their time exploring Mount Desert Island. But the Skudik Peninsula is equally beautiful. The National Park Service now protects more than 1,300 hectares of land there. Skudik offers secluded beaches and peaceful hiking trails.
In summer months, visitors can take a boat from the town of Bar Harbor on Mount Desert Island to the town of Winter Harbor on Skudik Peninsula. The tiny fishing town is a great place to enjoy Maine lobster in many forms. A few small family-owned restaurants serve classic Maine dishes like lobster soup, lobster rolls, or simple steamed lobster. But wherever visitors explore in Acadia, they will leave wishing they could see more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.